Hi, hope you've had a good week. Today's shiur is something different. We're going to be talking about the issues of conflict between what you hear, what some of you will hear. When you're exposed to the academic world, on your way home from seminary or otherwise, and what you know to be true. So, our class today is, of course, as always, dedicated to the memory of Rachel Leibas Rav Chaim Tzvi, and it should be an aliyah for HaNeshama. So first I want to talk about the problem. Okay, the problem has three aspects. The first aspect is that we value Tahara. So what is Tahara? If I was holding in my hand a cup, and I told you this cup, I'm sure you will see the cup, the non-existent cup, the cup contains honey. And I would say it's pure honey. That means it's only honey, not something else. So what truth is essential reality. Not reality plus agenda, not reality plus will, but reality as it is. So from that perspective, a pure person is a person who is genuinely human, who has nothing impeding their spiritual soul, which is what makes them a human and not an animal from being expressed. So Tahara has an opposite. The opposite is tumah, which means blockage. The ultimate blockage is death. When a person is dead, they can do nothing at all. They're completely blocked. So spiritual tahara means spiritually being unblocked. Every sin creates a mechitza. Spiritual tumah means being blocked by something. It could be desire, it could be envy, it could be all sorts of things. So the Ramah will talk about how every limb and organ requires veins to feed it blood. And if there's a blockage, that limb or that organ will wither and die. It will become gangrenous. So in the same way, we try to do everything we can to prevent our own blockage. So we know, for instance, eating non-kosher food, the Gemara tells us it leads to timtum halev, which isn't a cardiological condition. It means it causes you to lose sensitivity of the heart. Now, how that works with kashrut is a different topic. We could talk about it in a different frame, not today. But we're told that this is the cause and effect. So, because we value tahara, we try to protect our children and ourselves from an environment in which lack of tahara is normal. So that means also lack of truth, lack of spiritual integrity. And there's a reason why we try to be so protective. People will sometimes say, well, if what you're saying is true, what are you so afraid of? Why can't you just stand up for the truth? So I want to quote Rambam, who, if anything, was certainly an open-minded individual. It's human nature, he tells us, not human weakness, to be influenced by our environment. And he speaks about two levels of influence, the influence of the social environment, wanting the acceptance that comes from feeling at home in the culture that surrounds you, and personal influence. We want our friends to approve of us. We tend to consciously or subconsciously adapt their beliefs and opinions. So with that in mind, we're unapologetic about wanting tahara. So the result of that is that if a person has a lev tahor, a heart that's itself, that's tahor, that's unblocked, then they're a stranger to all of the agents of blockage. They don't identify the various forces for what they are. So, to understand this more concretely, suppose you grew up watching cartoons. People have done worse things than that. And cartoons sometimes are pretty violent. There's a lot of, you know, like Bugs Bunny or whoever, like picking up a stick and walloping somebody over the head, and then the cartoon says, boing, and the person is dead, and they're like angels go up. So what's the effect of that? The effect of it is that you're not so scared of the concepts. Okay, they are common. They're also falsified, but they're common, so you're not so scared of them. In Buddhist theological legendary, Prince Buddha lived a life in which he was completely protected. And when he saw human pain, he was torn apart to the point that he tried to ultimatize compassion as a value. So the reason I'm giving you a foreign example, I could have found a Judaic example, is that this truth concerning tuma and tahara leading to callousness and lack of callousness is accepted by everyone. So because of this, somebody grew up in a relatively secularized environment, let's say someone who went to a modern Orthodox school and was exposed to teachers, and certainly in the secular department, from a great variance of background, they've already heard it. They've already heard that they say something we don't say. And they got used to it. You know, boing, you know, that sort of. They don't have to take it so seriously. Conversely, if you grew up at Tahara, and you find yourself going to college, and some of the professors, even in the more protected colleges, are people with a very secular view of life. And they start talking to you about things like age of the universe, evolutionary fossil record, code of Hammurabi, and all of the liberalism, okay, that comes out of people's mouths like water. If you haven't heard it before, then you don't have a protective armor built up. So for that reason, it's normal for somebody to hear who's hearing this for the first time or the second time or whatever, to not quite know what to do with themselves. So I can give you an example with myself. I could hear almost anything and say, oh, this is what they think. Oh, what they think is that, you know, Thor created the world. Oh, that's ancient Northern pagan thought. Oh, it doesn't even enter that anyone takes this seriously. And if it were to, I would probably have enough distance, both by my disposition and by the fact that I was exposed to an awful lot of stuff awfully young. But for someone who would hear something like that, the first time, well, how do I know it wasn't Thor? Who was? You know, it's a different reality. So because of this, seminary students sometimes don't know what to do with themselves. And this is a reflection of the tahara, of their chinuch, of their purity of heart, of their not being damaged. It's not something to be ashamed of. There's not something to be ashamed of in not being callous and not being damaged. It's fine. So that's the first thing you have to know. The second thing you have to know is it says, Don't turn after your eyes and after your heart. So what does it mean, after your heart and after your eyes? Turning after your heart, the Gemara tells us that's heresy. Turning after your eyes is desire. Now, the Torah never tells us not to do something that we would never do. The Torah never says, for instance, don't breathe out unless you've breathed in. That's dangerous. If the Torah tells us to do something, it means that people will want to not do it. And if the Torah tells us not to do something, it means people will want to do it. So what the Torah is setting forth is our meridians that you could use for making free choices. So the fact that it says don't turn after your heart, and that means heresy, means that people, by the nature of things, oftentimes will want to turn after their heart and adapt heresy. Why will they? Why will people be more drawn by heresy than they are by truth? And why aren't they repulsed by it? So notice it says, don't turn after your heart. It doesn't say don't turn after your mind. The difference between a tzaddik and a rasha is that a tzaddik's mind controls his heart, while a rasha will find that his heart is controlling his mind. So to quote Ramban, the reason why Jews worship idols is that they want a reason to justify public promiscuity. Meaning the belief system invariably leads somewhere that feels good with one's already existent emotional agenda. So this is why people are drawn to heresy. They want to find a nice, easy way of justifying patterns of behavior that that are comfortable. I remember once hearing at one of the Chabad public gatherings when I was young. I don't remember the exact words that the Rebbe said, but the general idea was, and remember, he was credible for speaking like this. He had also suffered through what everyone of his generation suffered. He said he never met anybody who smoked after the war who didn't enjoy a good cigarette. There's a lot to that statement. So the reason I'm saying all of this is now you have two things to realize. One is that you don't have armor built up because you're a sensitive person with deep reservoirs of purity, and that that's good. And the other is that anything that the professor says may be touching something within you that you're not necessarily conscious of, that wants to hear, and maybe b'chol ofen, in order to make it possible for you to entertain not taking the Torah so seriously. There's a third consideration. The third consideration is authority. Okay, I used to take authority much more seriously than I do now. In my own lifetime, I'm not a million years old. I remember when I grew up, the nutrition of the day required that you have lots of whole milk, 3 glasses of whole milk a day minimum. That you eat red meat because there's lots of protein there, and that canned vegetables or frozen vegetables are just as nutritious as the fresh stuff, so you should have vegetables, and you should have a starch, and that's like a balanced diet. You know, don't eat all that sugar, there's some things that are always there, but a good meal would be, let's say, from their perspective, from the non-Jewish perspective, a steak, some potatoes, some canned vegetables, maybe some ice cream for dessert, especially if it's milchic ice cream, and a nice glass of whole milk to wash it all down. Today, people would call that heart attack alley. Now, between what they thought then and what they thought today, there were many other things that have had ups and downs. And this is in one lifetime. Coconut oil was terrible. Coconut oil is good. Olive oil is terrible. Only vegetable oil is good. Olive oil is good. Vegetable oil is cancerous. You need a lot of protein. You don't need so much protein. It doesn't matter if vegetables have been processed. Vegetables should be organic. Eat lots of milk products. They'll build your bones and teeth. You don't need all of that dairy. It's completely unnecessary. Try to get your calcium from other sources with less fat. Nuts are empty calories. Nuts are very healthy. This is in one lifetime. And the jury's still out, as you know. So just because the person who's speaking to you has letters after his name doesn't necessarily mean that he knows the full and final picture. Anyone who likes science knows that science is continually evolving. So I want to give you an example that will illustrate this. Let's say you have an x-ray of someone's broken arm. Okay, it's accurate. The x-ray tells you where the arm is broken and that it's broken. Doesn't tell you how long it'll take to heal. It doesn't tell you how the patient will feel. It doesn't tell you if they'll regain absolute and perfect motion. So it shows you what it shows you, but it doesn't show you more than what it shows you. So the reason I'm mentioning this is that science by its nature is continually evolving. We could see this much today and more tomorrow and more the next day. So oftentimes, things that were thought to be factual or the whole picture turn out to be not so. I'll give you an example of this. I don't know, even I'm not old enough for this, but there were operations called lobotomies that were done. At one point, neurologists believed that there were unnecessary parts of the brain that there are parts of the brain that just are responsible for hostility and aggression. And if you have somebody who's overly emotional or who's hostile or aggressive, just do a little surgery and do a lobotomy and they'll be fine. And what they got were people who have no ability to express emotion at all, who are like human robots, who have no expression and no life. Oops. Okay. They thought the appendix was an unnecessary vestige from another era of development. Oops, it's part of the immune system. Sorry. Okay. As are the tonsils and adenoids. And there's more. I remember, and this is going to shock people, when autism, and if you look at medical books that were written in the 50s and the early 60s, you could still see this. Autism is a consequence of overly educated mothers having a cold and distant relationship to their children. How do you like that one? So what they saw, now where were they coming from? I understand where they were coming from. They saw that autistic children don't speak. They saw that speech is developed through imitation. They concluded that women who don't speak to their children won't allow their children to have the model to imitate. They assumed that the sort of woman who won't speak to a child is a woman who isn't comfortable lowering her discourse to the level of a child. I want you to hear the words I've just used. They assumed, they assumed, they assumed, they assumed. It was a hypothesis. Turned out to be untrue. A lot of science is true. A rule of thumb is that the closer something is to observable physical reality, using the old-fashioned scientific method, observable, repeatable, definable, is more likely to be true than something that requires many assumptions along the way. So with this in mind, we'll talk about a couple of things, not many things because of time limitation. We'll talk about the Code of Hammurabi. So, where did morality come from? Did it come from Moshe at Har Sinai? Or did it come from Hammurabi, who wrote a code? And this code was the first one in which many of the phrases that we find in the Torah actually appear. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, for instance. So, what do we actually know? We actually know that there seems to have been a ruler called Hammurabi who seems to have written a code. We don't know anything else. So the first thing to do is to shave away everything else from that picture, because everything else is supposition as opposed to information. In terms of the timeline, Hammurabi may or may not have been Nimrod, which would be an interesting thing. Okay, possibly that would suggest that he had contact with Avraham. I can't tell you I know factually he was Nimrod. It's a possibility, given that Nimrod is presented to us as having lived in the right era and having ruled over the right countries, but maybe not. No matter what we would know is that Avraham personally sent his son Yitzchak to study in what was called the Yeshiva of Shem and Aver. Who was Shem? Who was Aver? Shem was Noah's eldest son. His name literally means name, because he was the one whose tradition was to seek to define things and to know them, to be able to answer the question, what is it and what is it for? He's the ancestor of what later became the Semitic nations, which are, of course, the Jewish, Islamic, and Christian nations, all of which are the ones who have the most spiritual and intellectual force in the world at any era. Ever was his grandson. So they had a yeshiva. Now, what do you think they learned in the yeshiva? The yeshiva Shem Masechtas? Michtav Mei Eliyahu? Night Seder? What do you think they learned? So in order to answer that question, we would have to ask, and how did Adam know anything? And the answer is, Adam was created knowing. Adam was created knowing. He understood the answer to these two questions, what is it and what is it for, in a way that we no way have access to grasping. His depth of knowledge and his experiential interpretation of the world is light years beyond where we are. He passed it on. How did they pass it on? They passed it on through oral tradition, through teaching. This was the yeshiva that was established by Shem. It was the yeshiva that taught Adam's teachings. So these basic ideas were in the world. Ideas concerning justice, ideas concerning mercy, ideas concerning non-chaotic structuring of society. It was all in the world. Whether people felt bound to it or not, whether they understood that the source of all of this was monotheistic or not, very much depended on where people were standing in life, what their emotional agendas were, as well as their rational agendas. So in that sense, Avraham in his time was the only one who understood monotheism in its pure sense and understood that all of these laws that are being passed down in the yeshiva are the laws of the one God telling us how to reach him and how to make his world work. Did other people have access to it? Yes. Arguably, could they have corrupted it? Possibly. We don't know. So could Hammurabi, if he was Nimrod or if he wasn't Nimrod, have had contact with Avraham or with somebody else who had access to the yeshiva? Absolutely. Could that have been the basis of some of what he put into his code? Why not? Could he have corrupted it because of his own agendas? Certainly. All we know is that he existed and had a code. Anything else is supposition. Anyone who can claim to know much more than that isn't being honest. But my supposition, which is that he somehow was exposed to knowledge that existed in the world, certainly fits our tradition, and certainly seems to fit everything that we see later in the stories in the Chumash. The fact, for instance, that Shimon and Levi killed the people of Shechem. How are the people of Shechem supposed to know that abducting a woman is a bad idea? Where is that supposed to come from? Why did Paro think that it's a bad idea to kill a man and steal his wife? Says who? In the animal kingdom it happens all of the time. Okay, so there obviously was some sense of basic morality that was floating around there. So it's no surprise to me that he would have known some of it as well. Especially since the only access they would have to this would come through study or through contact with someone who studied. The least surprising part of it is that some of the words will be the phrases that appear later in the Torah. Same author. Okay. So that would be my thoughts on Hammurabi's code. So I want to put myself now in the place of a girl straight out of seminary who may not be so familiar with the idea of Torah Keduma, the Torah of Adam, who may be blown away by an authoritative professor saying, and this really is, of course, the beginning of biblical literature, far, far before the Sinaitic legend even began to... Okay. And she's like, wow, how do you answer this? So the advice I want to give you to begin with is you take three steps back and you say, oh, that's what Professor McKenzie thinks, and file it away that way. Then later, you could ask yourself, how much of this is true, and how much of this is supposition? How much of this fits into what I know to be true? And how much is this likely to be considered mythic or legendary in 10 years from now? So to conclude this part, I want to share with you something that I found very, very interesting. My father was a soldier in World War II. He was in the American Army. They had little books they would give the soldiers. They were called pocketbooks, but they were much smaller than paperback novels that are also sometimes called pocketbooks. They were small on every possible topic. So the soldiers would have something to read. So my father had some of the Judaic pocketbooks. A very, very well done condensed version of the Kuzari. I'm trying to remember who wrote it. I think it was Rabbi Jung who did it. And he had some biblical criticism also, which I don't know if he read or not, but I know that I read it. And it was, first line biblical criticism. possibly because they had to condense it, and possibly because this is what whoever condensed it also thought was overtly anti-Semitic. Yes, the Jews were in Egypt. The Egyptian hieroglyphics show that as well. But they were a slave race. They weren't people of dignity. They weren't people who really deserved to be anything better than slaves. They were driven out of Egypt because they were repulsive, because they were filthy, because you have the general stream of thought. Now, for years, when people would see that the resultant biblical criticism, the Jed system, where they thought that the different names of God were reflective of different gods, etc., you would think that it was written by an objective scientist. It was written by a cheap anti-Semite. Okay, this is true of many things. When you have historical distance, you could see the agenda, but when you're up close, you can't. Don't take everything that Professor McKenzie says to heart just because he said it. The fact that he said it only means that he said it. You would have to learn to examine what's true here and what's not. Okay, now, let's look at another issue. The issue of the age of the universe. So, again, what will people hear and what will people think? You grew up at Tahara. You read Chumash Bereishis. Hisheshes yamim asa Hashem et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz v'yom ha-shvi shabbat v'nafash. That's clear enough. Then people are talking to you about fossil records, carbon-14, the astrological proofs, the expanding universe, the rate of expansion in the universe. Okay. So, what solid comes from all of this? So, in every possible dating system, remember one thing. Nobody even tries to answer one very basic question. Not what's the process of the universe's evolution, that's what they're trying to answer. But how did something, no matter what that something is, come from absolutely nothing? It's not even a question they take on. The process of how the one who brought something out of absolute nothing made a world that looks like the world we live in today, that's what they talk about. But they don't know, and they don't even try sincerely. I shouldn't say sincerely, it's not right. But the focus of their attention is certainly not the mystery of life. So realize that inherently, all that you're experiencing is seeing a different description of process. So even from their perspective, even if you're listening to a professor who happens to be an atheist, there's no proof to back up his atheism. All he has proof of, even from his perspective, is the way the process seems to look. So let's look at carbon dating. So the underlying thesis of all carbon dating is if this is how it looks today, and it looks like that tomorrow, it'll look like that the day after, and yesterday it looked, and the day before it looked, and the day before that. So on that basis, the carbon record will show the world to be far, far older than what our sources will, on an apparent level, say that the world is. But here's what isn't considered in carbon dating. Carbon dating assumes that the rate of dating is unchanging and that the world never really changes. How do you know? How do I know? How do they know? Do they know how the Ice Age would have affected dating? Could they know? No. So there are many questions that this brings up. I'm not saying that that's a proof of anything. The only thing it's a proof of is how extremely narrow the system is. Okay, let's take something further than that. When you talk about the Earth's beginning and the Earth's layers, when you look at high school textbooks, it's all very neat. There's this, and then there's this, and then there's this, and then there's this, and then there's this. But when you look at geology, it's mushed. It's like this. Okay, it's easy, especially if there's an existent agenda, to see absolute reality where there's only question marks. Why is the earth layered? I don't pretend to know the answer to that. But that doesn't prove anything except that the earth in some places is layered and in some places less so. There used to be dinosaurs, and that's a proof of something. I can't even imagine what that's supposed to be a proof of, other than there were dinosaurs. Do we have biblical tradition that there weren't dinosaurs? No. Do we have biblical tradition that there were dinosaurs? No. Do we have biblical tradition that during the Great Flood many species were extinct? Yes. Could one have been the dinosaurs? Yes. Do we know with any certainty that it was? No. So the important thing is to figure out where factuality begins and ends, and where suppositions take over. Now, this is tricky because sometimes a hypothesis is true. Then again, sometimes it's not. In terms of emotional agenda, oftentimes people will say, well, people who believe in the truth of the Torah have an agenda, and science has no agenda. So I want to point out one very interesting thing, since we're talking about the age of the universe and the fossil record. You may have heard of Peking Man. Peking Man is one of the many missing links between ape and man that were discovered. It was a skull. Okay, it was supposed to be the link showing that there were beings that weren't quite human or quite ape, but were the missing link. Now, from a Judaic perspective, by the way, and I feel it very important to stress this, so what? All we know is that there's some creature that had a skull shaped like this. For it to be called human, it would have to have a spiritual soul. Do we know that all people who have spiritual souls have skulls that look like yours and mine? No. Do we know what people looked like before the flood? No. Okay. This might have been a person with a spiritual soul. We do know that that's the definition of being a human and not an ape. And we do know that the spiritual self can't be defined by jawbones. Okay, but leave this alone. I want to go back to talking about Peking Man. So this skull was supposedly discovered in Peking. It supposedly was something between a human and between an ape. It later was discovered to be a fraud. Now, it's not the first or last fraud, by the way, to take place in evolutionary science, but this one became very well known. Why is it relevant to what we're talking about? I'll tell you why. Someone did the fraud, obviously. The skull didn't paste itself together. What was that person thinking? Were they thinking, I'm furthering scientific inquiry? Is that what they were thinking when they falsified the record? Or were they thinking, egocentrically, I want people to believe what I believe, and I'm willing to do anything to see that that happens? Or were they thinking financially, boy, if I do this, I might get the Nobel, that's $72,000 today, I don't know what it was then. So we don't know, but we do know is that there was falsification, which proves that there was emotional agenda. So don't see things bigger than life. Judaism has never been afraid of science, and I want to tell you why. The reason is science is the picture of reality as we know it this minute. There's nothing wrong with taking a snapshot of reality as we know it this minute. The only problem Judaism will ever have with science is if they'll look at the snapshot and they'll say we see everything. No intelligent scientist says that. Only fools say that. So I want to conclude by talking to you about something that actually happened. A friend of mine was dying of cancer. She fought it for a few years, but it spread. And she was in the hospital in England. A doctor, looking at her latest test results, felt that it was his responsibility to tell her that from what he sees, she has 2 weeks left. The spread is so huge that it was going to get to her vital systems, from his perspective, within 2 weeks. She wasn't ready to go at all. She became hysterical, which I think is a very reasonable response to that sort of news, if you love life and you love your family and you love doing another mitzvah. So her husband consulted with Rav Matisyahu Solomon Shlita, and he said, a scientist could tell you honestly, this is what I see. Meaning, I see a tumor, I see its progression from my past experience, it spreads at this and this rate. If it continues spreading at this and this rate, then the results will be whatever. He could describe what he sees, but he can't tell you what will happen. Why? Because Hashem intervenes as he wants to. He can cause the tumor to grow more slowly if he wants to, or he can cause the body to resist it more tenaciously if he wants to. And in fact, this woman lived another 6 months. So the reason why I'm telling you this is that Judaism will never have an issue with science as long as the scientists are humble, as long as they know that what they say only goes so far. The same thing holds true with all of the liberal theories. Yes, there's social discord. Yes, there's profound poverty. Identifying the problem doesn't mean that you know the solution. They tend to feed you this equation. If you don't accept my solution, it means that you don't accept the severity of the problem. That's not so. The fact that you could see the problem doesn't always mean you know a solution. So again, Judaism isn't afraid of the question. They're afraid of the haphazard tendency to create solutions that solve nothing. So with that in mind, I'll end for today. I hope you enjoy the rest of your experience in college. And now to do birur. Birur is a mystic term meaning take out what's holy and good and reject what's evil. Have a great day.